The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon to check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is opera, baseball, and traveling the world to create art. My guest this week is a man of intense confidence, which seems like a prerequisite for the work that he does. Michael Fabiano is an opera singer and also a former baseball umpire, debater, and business student. Opera was a side passion for him until a teacher told him that his talent was so great that he had a moral obligation to dedicate himself to cultivating his art to the exclusion of all else. And so that's just what he did, though he still makes time for casual hobbies every now and then, like flying airplanes. And by the way, Michael just released a new album of songs. Check out Michael Fabiano, Verdi, and Donizetti to hear him present a spectacular set of songs. We'll have that conversation in a moment. First, a quick reminder that I host twice monthly hangouts on YouTube, where I chat with you about the books and movies and music and shows that you're obsessed with right now. The next one is on Saturday, June 22nd at 9 a.m. Pacific, and there's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And also, for more queer podcasting, check out my show Queens of Adventure, featuring drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons comedy quest. We're doing a special preview weekend at the end of June, making over 20 hours of backer-exclusive bonus episodes available for anyone to listen to. Visit queensofadventure.com or follow at Dungeon Drag on Twitter, where we'll post more information in the next few days. Now, here's Michael. This week I'm speaking with Michael Fabiano. Thanks so much for joining me.
Great to be with you today. Thanks so much.
So what's the entertainment that changed your life?
As an opera singer, I have to say, I never anticipated being an opera singer. And so what it was watching a DVD of an opera unexpectedly when I was sick with mono in my first year of college. Music had always been in my family. We grew up listening to classical music, but I shied away from it when I was in high school. I listened to lots of pop music and different kinds of rock and different stuff. And when I was in college, I just got super sick in my first semester. I mean, we're talking 3-4 weeks out of school, sick with mono. And my mother brought this DVD from out of town of the opera called Mephistopheles by Boito and asked me to watch it with her. And I watched it. And in watching that one DVD, I realized, oh my God, this is something I love beyond love. I couldn't believe it. And then I fell madly in love with opera, and I had no real pretext for it before that moment.
What was going through your mind while you were watching?
Many things. How is it possible that drama, music, acting, sets, colors, costumes, everything can be in all in one event at one time in such a dynamic way? And in this opera, Mephistopheles, which I saw in this DVD that was made in 1989 from San Francisco Opera, from the San Francisco Opera, I was just overwhelmed about what I was seeing, because I had, you know, in high school when we were in choir, all those things, we grew up watching musicals and knew what Broadway was, and people loved Les Mis and different musical theater pieces. I had no idea that there was something this grand and this spectacular that existed.
Why, you said that your mother brought it to watch? Why
Yes.
did she think that this was something that would be fun to watch together?
Well, two things. Again, both of my parents came from a discipline of music, and more of my mother specifically of a choral tradition, and this opera, it leans heavily on choral music. So she brought it knowing that she loved the music herself and assumed that I would love it too for that reason. The second is that there was a lot of time to kill. She brought other things to watch too. It just happened that this is the first thing she put in, and that's what we ended up watching.
And what are you seeing on screen when you're watching it?
The opera, this incredible spectacle, a magnificent spectacle that even in this production made in 1989 has rarely been replicated in other productions in theaters around the world, of its grandeur and size and splendor.
So I think when people, if they're not familiar with opera, might just think that it's just somebody standing there singing. So what is it like happening on stage that's so grand?
So for the listener that doesn't know anything about opera, these are the things I would say. Opera is the greatest combination of drama, music, lighting, costumes, dance, everything you can imagine that you'd expect in even a concert you'd see at Coachella or some festival that's outdoors. It is absolutely the greatest spectacle there is on earth, with the huge caveat that it includes completely unamplified voice, meaning not a single singer on the stage ever has amplification. There's nothing like that exists. And there's an orchestra in a pit that contains up to 108 instruments, depending on the opera, by which singers have to sing over the top of. And as such, it requires, as a singer, as a performer, it requires us to be dynamic, strong, well-trained. But as a viewer, it's something that's out of this world. And for someone that's never been there before, I would try to ask people to just consider what are the most incredible musical events they've seen, and then come to an opera and realize that it's essentially that. It's not stasis where people just stand and sing. It is everything that you can dream of in Broadway without amplification and better music.
What was your background in music at that point?
Interesting. So I went to college with the intention to study business. And when I was in high school, I was in Lincoln Douglas debate, a near champion in it. I was in mock trial, Model United Nations. I did all the things that one would do in an intellectual sense in high school. On top of that, I was a baseball umpire. So there was really no indication in high school that this was going to be my direction. I had an intellectual bent that I thought was going to send me in the business/legal realm. I wasn't quite sure when I got to University of Michigan, but that is what it is. And when I got there, I decided to take some voice lessons, and because I always enjoyed singing, I was in choir. People always said that I had this strange vibrato in my voice when I was in high school. Some made fun of it even, I have to say. But I didn't think much about it because it was never something in the concourse of my thought would be my life. I never considered it to be something that important to me. But getting to college and getting on this track, my God, just things changed drastically and very dramatically in a very fast frame of time.
That's pretty incredible that you were looking at debate and business and baseball, and opera seems so distant to those things.
Completely. It has, I mean, in effect, now that I've been doing it, we can discuss at length how I actually see huge connections between all of them, because I've been doing this now for over a dozen years professionally. Hmm. But at the time, no, there was no connection between any of it. Nothing. Now looking back, I see all the connections, and it makes a lot of sense now that it ended up being my career path. I just didn't see that at the time. I didn't even see it coming.
Well, so what are those connections?
Okay. I'll break it down really simply. So as a baseball umpire, I umpired baseball from the age of 14 to 24, all the way up into the Babe Ruth leagues. I never got higher than that, but baseball umpiring was one of the sources of income for me even when I was in college. It was something I love. I love it to this day. Being an umpire requires an assiduous understanding of the rule of law within baseball, meaning knowing every single rule perfectly. So when I umpired a game, not only did I have to know the rules, did I have to know constructively the laws, I had to be authoritative about adjudicating the rules, making sure that people were compelled that when I made a call, everything was justified. And even if it was a bad call, if I screwed a call up, that I could still stand by it. That's something that I would say is pretty cardinal to baseball. Even, by the way, as a sidebar, debate that everybody's having today that, you know, umpires are not completely perfect. But the reality is nothing is perfect. So umpires come pretty close. Anyway, as a comparison, as an opera singer, it is imperative to a musician to learn music as credibly and as accurately as possible, because our duty as musicians is to deliver the music that is on the page as well as possible in order to please as many people that come to witness the art that we present. Mm-hmm. And so the great comparison is, and the great learning that I got in advance was, I prepared assiduously, deeply, to learn all and every single rule in the book for baseball. I studied it manically, and that's what I do with music. And so when I came and when I switched pathways when I was 19 effectively and began my musical pathway, studying music in a critical, analytical way was natural to me. It came to me. So it meant that I was able to learn music with a rapidity that many of my colleagues didn't even have the ability to do at a young age. And it was only because of the baseball training and experience that I had that I was able to do it.
That's such an interesting connection, but it seems like accuracy and faithfulness to what is on the page is really what it comes down to.
Absolutely correct. You know, there's this debate. You know, we can even talk about the law, about originalism, constructionalism, when it comes to Supreme Court justices, and do people follow the letter of the law or the intention of the law, right? Well, the same thing applies to music. When we talk about opera, for your listeners out there, one can look at the page of music and say, I'm going to sing exactly what is prescribed on the page. I'm going to do exactly what the composer writes, or I'm going to interpret what the composer wrote and play with it to a degree within the confines of the music. My burden as a singer, though, I believe, is to come as close as possible to delivering what the composer intended, because it's in delivering that music as closely as intended that the public gets the greatest reality of the music that was written.
Okay, I guess, yeah, I see what you're saying, that there's a reason that people come to the show, and that is for the work that was put down on paper, you know, sometimes, you know, a century or two ago, and they want to hear somebody master what is essentially an extremely difficult thing to reproduce.
I think that's one of the reasons why people come. I think the audience in the opera world is made up of 25% of people who have a deep and passionate love for the art and understand the music. And so they want to hear the music as it is. 50% of them are people that are casual people that come sometimes, enjoy it, but don't really care about that fact. They just want to hear great singing, and they want to see a great spectacle. And then there are 25% of the people that come that don't know much, seldom come to the opera, maybe have never come before, or are students, and just are there to only have a great experience, not expecting anything else. My feeling is, if I can fulfill the responsibility of the first 25% of the people that I described, mm-hmm. I'm doing everybody justice. But if I only look for the people at the last 25%, as I described to you, or even 75%, and not the 25, I'm losing at least a base of the people that I am there to serve.
So when you went to college, you'd had this experience where you watched the video and you were really struck by it. Did you, like, at that point, had you been to an opera previously?
The answer is no. I saw when my aunt was 5 years old. My aunt sang on operatic stages in Europe. I saw her perform once in a theater in New Jersey, but being five and remembering that experience is very limiting. So until I got to college, the answer is no, I did not.
After having that experience with the tape, and I know, like, being sick, it can affect your perception of things. What did you have, like, an awakening where you're like, I got to go seek out more of this?
No, a lot of things happened concurrently. So the story is this: I was sick, I was ill. I was also taking music lessons around that time, before and after having mono, with a man named George Shirley. He was the first African-American tenor to sing at the Metropolitan Opera. He won the Metropolitan Opera competition in 1960, and he has a very distinct history with his performing. at the Met through 1973, and then subsequently an international career after that. I was taking vocal lessons with him before and after mono, but I was doing it casually. It wasn't my love. It was just elective and interesting. But George said to me in my first lesson, I'll remember it forever. He says, do you realize the talent you have, Michael? And I said, I don't understand. He says, do you realize how good your talent is? No. He says, you have a talent that the students that have preceded you and likely the students that will come after you will never have. And you have a huge responsibility to your talent. And if you don't fulfill your responsibilities to your talent, you are denying the public a right to have great art. And to hear that moral imperative as a young person is scary, is alarming, difficult to hear, and chilling. But the reality is I heard it before I saw this DVD, and then I saw this DVD with my mother when I was sick. And then a few weeks later, I went back, continued my lessons with Professor Shirley, who said to me subsequently, if you don't commit to studying music full time, I no longer want to teach you. So the pressure was on for me to really deliver. And I have to say that after between hearing a moral imperative, seeing that DVD, and knowing that I really added a lot of joy for this art form, I jumped ship and I started studying music, and I graduated Michigan in just 3 years.
When you say you jumped ship, like what ship were you on, like, that you jumped? Like, did you have other interests that you're like, just assumed, it's going to be business or whatever?
Yeah, I was in the business track. I was studying economics. I speak Spanish. I was very aggressive in studying Spanish at the time. I wasn't exactly sure. I was only an undergraduate in my first year. But my intention was never to study music when I went to college at all. Zero. My intention was to go into business in some form or maybe, but this is all so superfluous because it hasn't happened, maybe go into law, but none of those things have ever been realized.
What did that look like to make that switch? Like, were you taking like completely different classes all of a sudden and hanging out with different people?
You know, what I remember is it was only one semester, and my first semester, one of my classes was vocal music lessons. One was economics, one was Spanish, and one was an English course, if I remember right. That was it. And so switching, really, I just went from one music course to two, plus an elective, plus another mandated course. It wasn't a big switch, to be frank. It just was more music and less of what I thought I was going to study. It wasn't as grave. It wasn't like I jumped into a music pool and suddenly I didn't study anything else. I still had a comprehensive education. It just was less comprehensive on the liberal arts side of things.
Did you find yourself thinking about music, and particularly opera, in a different way at that point?
I think the moment I got to Michigan, my first week, even when I started studying and I was in the world of other people that loved music, I already started feeling the energy that it was something I wanted, but I didn't know enough about it at the time.
When you were getting deeper into opera and making that switch and I guess accepting that moral imperative, that like pressure that was put on you, did that seem like a lot to bear? Like you owe it to the world to sing to them?
Well, it's not that I owe it to the world to sing to them. It's that I owe it to the world to share the talent that other people might not have. There's a small difference between those two things. Lots of people can sing. Only certain people have a quality of talent that ought to be shared. And so that was the point that Mr. Shirley made from the beginning. There's a moral obligation there that I had to fulfill. And did I scare of it? It was scary initially, but because it came from a debate background and a mock trial background in high school, again, these weird concurrences in debate, in mock trial, in Model United Nations, one always dealt with moral imperatives when arguing a case, when arguing for something, when arguing against something. Mm. So when it appeared to me in real life as something that I had to, make a decision about, it was natural to make the decision about it.
So did you go from studying as basically a hobby, like just a personal interest, to having, I don't know, did the standards by which you were judging your own performance change once you're like, no, this is my thing. This isn't, I'm just not just doing it for me. I'm doing it for everybody else.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And here's a great example. After the first semester that I was studying with George Shirley, I had a number of people that I studied with who had told me that they had earned an A in their first semester from him for their work. And I came back, and if I recall correctly, George Shirley gave me a B. And I needed straight A's to remain in merit scholarship contention at the time. And getting that B completely obliterated that opportunity for me. So I remember knocking on the door of my professor after I got the grade and questioned him, why did I earn this low grade? And his answer was, you're not living up to your own potential. I said, but why does that matter if I'm doing what I'm asked to do? He said, you're different than those other people. Your responsibilities are greater. I don't see you in the library till 1 a.m. when the library is closed, studying music, studying scores, studying your languages, studying everything that's relevant in literature to everything in opera. And that was a wake-up call that here's a line that is of course, going to meet some disagreement, but no one person on this earth is equal to the next, even though we all ought to be treated equally under the law. Every single person has different talents and different abilities, and as such, in a scholastic sense, at least, should be treated differently. And this was an example that I learned the hard way. I learned it from George Shirley, the first African-American tenor to sing at the Metropolitan Opera, who was teaching me a really hard lesson about life, that there is no equality in arts or anything. Should we all have the opportunity at it? Sure. Should we all be treated the same when it comes to getting ahead, getting a job, getting an opportunity on stage? We should be treated on our ability. We should be treated on the merits. And his point to me was, I was not living up to the standards that a great musician was living up to. And that was a really hard lesson, I have to say. But it was a wake-up call. And so from then on, I have to tell you, I spent every night in that damn library until 1 a.m. And I learned everything on those racks.
Did you like that?
I loved it. I mean, right now I'm sitting in my apartment in London and there are, I don't know, 20 scores of music sitting on my table. And I'm leaving here in a few days. I've been here for 30 days. I mean, studying is my world. I love to study. I love to be informed, not just about my craft, by the way, about everything around my craft, everything outside of my craft, in other areas, in other disciplines. And I have to say, what I'm so grateful for is his one lesson, that one lesson instilled in me an even greater and more burning desire to gain information on a constant basis.
When you talk about the skills that you have to acquire, you know, the languages and learning about the history and the music, what does that translate to on the stage? Like, what's the outcome that the audience sees as a result of all that hard work?
It's a great question. I'd say many things. To be a successful opera singer, I say that it's not enough just to have a great voice or a great instrument or great instincts. That's not sufficient. It doesn't reach the sufficiency standard. To be a great performer on the operatic stage, one has to be able to understand every language with which they're singing. They have to be able to get in the head of the character of whoever they're singing on stage, which means not only do they have to understand the text as it is on the page, they have to get the syntax of why the text was written and the backstory about why the text was there. The complexity of understanding this kind of text is usually connected to literature, famous literature, Goethe, or things, other writers like that. Those are writers that I have to be familiar with as an opera singer. Even though I sing music, I have to know who those people are. Shakespeare. I have to know, you know, most of the Shakespeare works to sing most of the operatic literature. So knowing literature, knowing language, knowing culture, knowing what's going on culturally, being culturally aware, all of those things are relevant in being able to deliver a complex and comprehensive performance on stage as an artist. The difference between a singer and an artist is that a singer can sing beautiful notes and not really know what the hell's going on with the notes and why the notes exist. An artist is one that knows everything about the notes and the backstory of those damn notes.
What was the first show that you were in, like, after making that transition from someone who just liked opera to someone who was pursuing it with all of your focus?
The answer is that the first opera I did was called Gianni Schicchi. It's an opera by Giacomo Puccini. And I was only 19. It was only a year in at the university. And I was cast very prematurely, but they gave me the role because I was talented. And I'm grateful for it. And I wasn't quite ready to do it, but I did it. And the experience was enlightening. It also was a time when I was grossly obese, okay? For my years in college and before that, I was very heavy. And what I remember from the experience wasn't just that I enjoyed singing, but that I was out of breath constantly running around the stage. And in the years between 19 and 20, I realized that in order to be a successful performer on the stage, I had to have at least pretty good physical health. I had to be in good physical shape. That was the next new reality for me. It was not a sustainable future for me if I was grossly out of shape.
So there's so many different skill sets that you need on top of like your physical condition. It seems like there's a lot of pressure to just be the best at everything in this world that you're getting into.
I don't like the word the best. I think the best is limiting, because it means that one has to be near perfect or perfect. I don't believe in the best. I believe in being excellent. I think the definer for me in my world is that I know that perfection is unattainable, but I also know that good is not sufficient. So the tightrope act that I have to walk all the time is doing better than good, but never trying to be perfect. And the second I try to be perfect, I regress and become good or worse, because I end up losing focus on just delivering the craft at an optimal level.
Is that something that you, like a lesson that you had to learn? Like, was there a time when you were trying to be perfect?
Yes, exactly right. It's in my nature to work hard and know as much as I can about anything that I'm doing. I have a deep hunger for knowledge, and I have a deep hunger for an understanding of why I'm doing what I'm doing. And there were a number of years where I worked immeasurably to improve and get to the point where there could be no criticism of anything that I did. And the reality was that it created a psychological block for me that I couldn't actually beat it. I couldn't beat being perfect. And so it caused me some regression. It caused me some failures. It caused me to fall on my face a few times. It caused me to go below the threshold of good. So it created this new paradigm for me, which is what I laid out a second ago, that it's not sufficient to be good, but it's too much to be perfect. So seeking excellence is what one needs to do to be successful in an operatic career in a big, big way.
What are some of the shows that you're particularly proud of having been in?
Many. For instance, I've sung 116 performances of Rodolfo and La Boheme by Puccini. It's the most performed opera in the United States today. But La Boheme is an incredible opera in itself, and I've had the privilege of singing in a myriad of different productions around the world of this work. I've been able to sing the opera Don Carlo by Verdi. If your listeners don't know Don Carlo, it's a very dark opera that's has a very complex tale. But for the listeners that know anything about opera or the classical literature, they'll understand that singing Don Carlo is quite a war horse. of a role, and I was able to accomplish it at the age of 32. And I look forward to doing it many more times in the future.
Was there a pressure to focus so intensely on the work and learning and refining your skills that, I don't know, did you ever feel like the person that you were was disappearing into the work, that you were being subsumed by the product that you were putting in front of people? Taking over your actual like personal life.
An opera singer requires an immense amount of focus, an immense amount of discipline. It requires a person to effectively be a warrior that is going into battle at all times, which means I don't drink, I don't go to loud clubs, I travel around the world. People say, you get to go to all these wonderful cities, Michael, Paris, Madrid, Berlin, Munich, Sydney, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Barcelona, Rome, Milan, blah, 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 blah. Don't you have a great time in all those cities? And the answer is no, because I am there to deliver great art on the stages. I don't have a lot of time or energy to devote to being a tourist when I'm in all these places. I can't. If I do it, I don't have the energy to deliver on stage. I just don't.
Is there anything that you do to relax that isn't opera?
Yes, I fly planes.
Oh, that's pretty intense too.
It's a different intensity though. It's a completely different wheelhouse. For me, it's a different silo entirely from being a tourist or being loud. In fact, being a pilot doesn't require a lot of talking or being around people or running the risks of getting sick because I'm in public with a lot of people. Flying planes is another way for me to siphon off the energy of other things around me and focus on one thing only, which is flying and enjoying being above the earth. And so it's a great hobby for me. It's really my only big hobby that I have these days.
It really seems quite different because you're removing yourself so completely from everyone around you. It's so
But as you asked, is there something that I do that relaxes me and gets me out? And the answer is that, because it's so far different from anything else I do that I am completely out of the land of thinking of any music, thinking of any business propositions that I'm considering, anything else like that. All I'm thinking about is flying, and that's it. And the thing is, when I learned how to fly, again, it came easy to me because it requires an immense amount of study and an immense amount of focus on systems, on weather, on a myriad of factors that go into making sure that one flies safely. And I was able to figure that out quickly.
Have you ever had a chance to sing that, I forget the name, the opera that you watched with your mother?
Mephistopheles, funny enough. The production that I watched on DVD from San Francisco in 1989 was done at the Metropolitan Opera last year in November and December. It was put in the season at the last moment, and the Met asked me in March of last year, would I like to do it? And the answer was yes, and I was very touched and flattered to have that opportunity because it was the defining moment, I would say one of them, that caused me to shift my thinking on opera. So I got to ultimately swing around 16 years later and do it on stage.
You mentioned that one of the things that attracted you to opera was the intensity and the extremity of emotion. Have there been characters that you've played or roles that you've played that resonated particularly strongly with you?
Yeah, there are different types of personalities that I've had to engender on stage. One-dimensional people like the Duke of Mantua and Rigoletto, where he's just kind of a sexaholic, a guy that likes lots of women and is a duke of a town, and who cares about him, and all he likes is a bunch of nothing. He's frivolous things. And he sings a couple of cool tunes, and that's it. That kind of character I don't understand, to be frank. I sing the role, and people enjoy the role. People enjoy the opera because it's a great opera, but it's not my personality. Then there are roles that are sympathetic people, that are humble, poor. They're men that witness a loved one die or they witness a great crime and they have to give an exposition about it over the course of a night. And I understand those kind of people and I enjoy playing those roles, though it's, again, one, two-dimensional. Then there are characters which I call sword characters, and often they don't carry a sword, but it's the kind of character that lives and dies by justice. So Romeo, for instance, is someone like that. But there are roles like Edgardo and Lucia di Lammermoor, Rodolfo and Louisa Miller, where there's a man that fights for justice, fights for other people, fights for the love of his life, and then ultimately are betrayed for some reason. And we discover in the end of the opera why they're betrayed, and it's because other people in the work have been duplicitous. And so, of course, what's so operatic about most of these pieces is these characters end up killing themselves or are killed at the end anyway. Opera is opera. It's fantastical, but it's also fantastic. And so that's a three-dimensional character that I love to play.
What are the emotions that you're feeling? Like, are you being very method about it and like drawing on your own experiences and inhabiting those emotions as you're performing?
Absolutely. So there's a role that I just sang for the first time called Werther. And it's based on, again, Goethe and the stories of Werther. And so what happens is there's this gentleman that has never really had a relationship with anyone prior to a moment that we witness in this work, Werther. He sees a woman. He becomes infatuated with her to the point that he thinks she's perfect. She's perfect because she is a lovely lady that cares for six orphans, and there's beauty just in that. He's not attracted to her physically, necessarily. He might be, but he's more attracted to the fact that she is a great human being. He falls in love with her instantly. It seems that the woman is falling in love with him as well. And then we discover midway through the opera that in fact, she's engaged and her husband is coming home and she cannot be with this man, Werther. And so over the course of the evening, we see Werther descending progressively from being in love to infatuation, to anger, bitterness, a bit of jealousy, even rage, and then ultimately deciding to kill himself because he can't bear to live on earth without being with this one person who he has decided is for him. And so when I sing this opera, I think of a moment in my life in the past where there have been people in my life that I have maybe become infatuated with or that I have had a deep affection for, but where I've been rejected. And it's seldom happened, but it's happened. It's happened. And so I'm able to effectively play the role because I go to that place. I recall those moments when I was clearly rejected. I recall those moments when it was not going to happen. Or I recall the moments when initially it seemed like it was amazing, and then something got in the way of that amazement. And that's what makes it special for me, and I think ultimately special for the public.
Is it therapeutic to process it in that way?
I never thought of it that way, but I think, sure, it is.
You're not the first person that I've had on the show who's spoken kind of unexpectedly to me about the importance of opera to them. Some of the earliest episodes that I've had of the show, people surprised me by talking about how opera either helped them through a difficult time in their life or helped them understand themselves better. And it seems like this isn't something that I expected, that it holds a place of importance, particularly for gay men. And I'm still, like, after talking to people at length about this, it's still not something that I fully understand. It's just something that I've observed. And I'm wondering if that's something you've experienced as well, or if that just happens to be the people that I've spoken to.
I'll speak to it in many ways, if you don't mind. I think this is a great, great question.
Sure.
First of all, I find that opera is a huge form of catharsis for many people, regardless if they're gay, straight, whatever they are, whoever they are, whatever state of life they're in. Because when people come into the theater and watch a work for 3 hours or 4 hours, they effectively check their daily rigors at the door and immerse themselves in something else. People come to the opera in order to be with everybody else on stage. They envision themselves with them. They envision themselves within the music. And just in that that idea suspends for 3 or 4 hours the difficulties of their day. But I'd say, secondly, that because there is this catharsis, the arts are so democratic for everybody. The arts are ultimately the most democratic forms of figuring out ideas. So when I'm watching an opera that involves ideas about justice, Lucia di Lammermoor, for instance, or Lucia di Lammermoor, or even Rigoletto, for instance, people can process concepts on stage and translate it into something that applies to their life within the context of justice. Justice is something that often is we talk about in the opera, on the operatic stage, and it comes through the consciousness of people watching when they're sitting in the stalls of the theater. And so when it comes to, specifically you asked about gay men, I think the word justice comes to me again, because there is so much to understand about the complexities of people and how life is very subjective and changeable at all moments. And with people that come from the queer background, justice comes forward and they think about the realities of the world and how they can overcome those realities. And they check again their feelings at those doors when they walk into the theater in order to immerse themselves in a democratic event of the arts. And so for me, it's an all-encompassing event, whether or not I'm on the stage or watching.
Is this something that you've spoken to other queer people about? Like, what sort of feedback do you get from queer fans and audience members?
You know, to be frank, I don't get a lot of feedback from a lot of queer fans and audience members. That's the honest answer. I just haven't. There have been a few. Mm-hmm. But I would say the one thing I've noticed, and it doesn't necessarily respond to my art directly, is that I'm openly gay in my world. I'm proud to be who I am. I'm proud to be married to my husband, who's with me here in London right now. A number of people have come to me and thanked me for being a tenor in my world that is open and willing to discuss who I am. Because the reality is, in the opera world, there are not many stars that are openly gay. There just aren't. It might seem strange to your listeners. You'd think, wow, the arts are probably littered with gays across the board, but not openly. It's a different world than one might think it is. So to be out and to be able to talk about it is, number one, a relief, but number two is a reward. It's a reward to be able to discuss who I am freely and willingly, and to know that it has an impact on my fans and my friends, and I'm very glad about that.
Did you have any concern about your career and how you'd be perceived being out, since it's so seldom that someone is openly gay in that theater world?
Of course. I mean, there were many years where I thought deeply about this problem, and it was something that held me back for a while. And I just decided to change, and that was it. I ripped the Band-Aid off at one point. I said, enough.
How did you do that?
I literally, you know, sometimes you just have to do a 180. Sometimes in life, when there is a burning garbage can of shit in front of you and you can't stop looking at it, sometimes you just got to walk away from that burning garbage can of shit and just walk in the other direction. And that's what it was, and the burning garbage can of shit literally was that I couldn't talk about myself. And so I decided, screw it, I'm going to just start talking.
What was the response?
Elation. People were happy. People were happy for me that the world is a far more open place than we give it credit for. And this is not just the arts world, this is the world. And so for the younger people out there that are not sure about themselves, there are a host of people out there that will have their arms open at all times. And that's it. And if people are concerned that they might lose their family or some friends, there are always other people that will be your family or your friends.
Is that what you found? Like, did you find like a chosen family after you came out?
No, because my family, very fortunate for me, was amazing. So I didn't have that fear. It's funny. I was always open with my family and my friends, but publicly, in a public sense, I never discussed it at a younger age. And there was I admit there was some naivety about it with me too. I didn't have enough information. I didn't want to jeopardize my standing and the sense that my career was not going to continue going upwards. There was a fear there, and it was a misplaced fear. It's just misplaced.
Did you find that without that burden on you, did that free you to pursue more performance, or did it free you to express yourself more openly on stage?
Didn't make a difference.
It wasn't something that you were carrying around with you as a performer.
No. Remember, one thing I do well is I'm good at compartmentalizing matters. So I don't take baggage on stage with me. I just don't. And there was some baggage there for sure before I decided to be fully open about my life. But I didn't take it on the stage.
Had you considered yourself part of a queer community before then? And do you consider yourself now, or is it all opera all the time?
It's all opera all the time, I would say. And am I part of a queer community? I don't know. I am very happily gay and proud to be who I am. I have gay friends. I have straight friends. I don't like to really ID myself as part of a community or not. I don't think it's helpful. I think I'm grateful to have all the friends and family that I have, and that's it.
Did you meet your husband through opera?
I did.
How did
but
that?
in a very unique way. Brian was at an opening night performance of mine at the Metropolitan Opera. He was at a party after the performance. I went up to him. He was standing with another gentleman at the time. Shook his hand. He introduced himself to me. I figured he knew who I was because I had just sung on the stage. And so I didn't introduce myself. I didn't say, my name is Michael Fabiano, et cetera, et cetera. And I asked Brian, how was the performance tonight? What do you think of the show? And Brian proceeded to say that he thought the performance was terrible. And at that moment, I realized that Mr. McAllister, my now husband, had no clue that he was talking to the man that just had sung on the stage of the Met. And Brian, as he does, continued to discuss and discuss and discuss about why things were not good that evening. And then suddenly, of course, another individual stood up to introduce the cast that was at this cast party. And I was standing right next to Brian, and I gave my little wave to everyone standing in the room. And Brian turned the color red and then proceeded to tell me how incredible I was after that moment. And I said, I'll see you later, walked away. Mm-hmm. But luck would have it that the chairwoman of the board had it that we were sitting across from each other at the dinner table that night.
Okay. And was that awkward?
It worked out perfectly. I didn't care. I really didn't. I mean, you know, the thing is, people, one thing that I've learned really well in my world is that everybody is entitled to have an opinion. And sometimes those opinions are not favorable to me. And I'm not here to force people to change their minds. The best I can do is give a great show. And if I win 75% of the people and I lose 25% of them, fine. If I win 51 and I lose 49, fine. As long as I'm above that 50 mark all times, I'm doing okay. And so in that night, I knew that I hadn't won that one person. But being able to have a cordial conversation with someone that still didn't think my artistry was good didn't matter to me. Because I liked the person. I enjoyed talking to him, and I thought he was a great guy. And then it just spun in a different, entire direction.
You may not have won him over on stage, but it seems like you won each other over afterwards. What was the thing that made you think, I want more of this person in my life?
Many things. I found him extremely easy to talk to. I found him to be a great listener, which I think is something that more and more these days, there are fewer people that are willing to listen. It's something that is plaguing our society today in this fast-moving world where people don't listen to each other. People don't ingest ideas that people might have that might run contrary to their own personal beliefs. Brian was able to listen. Brian listened. And that meant a lot to me. Listening means a lot. And that in itself was a huge prize. I'd say that Brian's history and his what he was doing, and he had some interests that were exciting in that night that I learned about him that I thought were really cool, and I wanted to follow it up.
What were those interests?
He's a scuba diver, and because I'm a pilot, if you scuba dive, you can't go flying for days. Mm-hmm. And if you're a pilot, you can't go underwater. So it was opposites, but, you know, in many ways, there's a yin and a yang there. So I loved learning about scuba diving that night with him. He has many different titles in scuba diving. It's one of his big pastimes. He likes to travel all over to go scuba diving.
It sounds like you also have he must have been interested in opera, at least to have been at the show.
Well, he's on the board at the Metropolitan Opera.
Ah.
That was why he was at the party. Mm-hmm. So he has a deep love and fascination of lyrical art and has been doing it been a part of it for many years.
Yeah, it sounds like you both have, a passion for the performance there, and also your escapes from it are both very solitary, in just the opposite direction.
Correct. Yeah.
But you also have that opera that you can come back to right in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely right.
What's your advice for folks who are not familiar with opera but are intrigued and would like to learn more and go to a show? Like, where should they go? What should they look? What should they listen to?
I would say many things. First of all, a simple practical observation. Opera is one of the most economical forms of theater there is right now in the United States or in the world to visit and enjoy. And it seems that would be completely untrue. One would say, oh my God, opera is elitist. Opera is only for the most wealthy people on the planet. The reality is that in most theaters right now, you can find seats for as low as $20 in 25% of the house. Now tell me where, when you go see a Nets game or any show on Broadway where you can get 20 seats in 25% of the stadium or the house. Mm-hmm. Tell me. That's the first thing. Opera is economical. That's number one. So if you're going to look for, you want to go take someone on a date, you're not going to spend as much money as you think taking someone to the opera. If you want to get the greatest seats in the house, it's going to cost you some money. Sure. Mm-hmm. You might get lucky too, because every once in a while there are schemes that the theaters run that get you great seats at great prices. That's the first. The second is, if you're a newbie, I want every listener to understand that the operatic form touches the soul. The music touches the bones in a way that all acoustic music can't, because it is implicitly unamplified. And there's something so unique and special about the unamplified use of music. There's a brilliance in the voice and in the sonority of the instruments when there is no amplification that hits the senses, hits the skin, hits the bones in a different way. And just that experience, that physical experience of sound, not even what it's about, but the physical experience of sound in an unamplified way is dynamic and different if you're new. The third is that opera tells stories that are most relatable in our life today. It just tells them in different languages, but often it tells them in a sound palette that is very approachable, accessible, and beautiful. So if I think of, for instance, the opera I spoke about earlier was La Boheme. It's a work that was written in 1896 by Puccini, It includes tunes that people hear in film all the time and might not realize that it's in film all the time. But it comes with a tone palette that is so universal and beautiful and tonal and encompassing and warm and romantic that it's easy to listen to, and it's easy to leave the theater remembering everything that you heard that night. That's something that's so spectacular about opera, that there's so much that one can recall from when they hear it on the first listen. And when I spoke about stories, La Bohème is a story that's relatable. It's about someone that dies of a disease suddenly, but more deeply about the love and passions of people realizing how terrible death is and how hard it hits the psyche. And many people can relate to those kind of issues in life, whether or not be because of people dying of cancer or other illnesses, or family members fighting over having the last moments with their loved ones. That's what La Bohème is. So there's so much at stake with opera that people that have never gone will get a lot out of. And the cherry on top is, if you go to the Metropolitan Opera and you see, for instance, La Bohème, you're going to see one of the most spectacular productions you'll ever see in your life, truly. So there's a lot to be gained from opera.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is not just there in the moment in the theater, although that's certainly grand, but it's something that you can take away after the show and carry around with you afterwards.
Absolutely.
Well, Michael, thank you again so much for chatting with me.
Great pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks again to Michael for joining me, and check out his new album, Michael Fabiano, Verdi and Donizetti. It's available to listen to on Amazon and Spotify and wherever you would expect to find great music. As I mentioned, I've had quite a few guests discuss their love of opera on the show, and you can hear more on episodes 4, 38, 89, and 127. All of those go into more depth on the genre and the craft. I know it can feel like opera has a certain barrier to it, like it's foreign or old-fashioned or too serious to understand. So my recommendation this week is for my favorite and most accessible piece of operatic culture, the Bugs Bunny cartoon What's Opera Doc, where Elmer Fudd chases bugs through Wagner's Ring Cycle. Of course, there is drag. But there's also real affection for the source material, with references to Siegfried's Horn and the horse from the actual opera, and Valhalla and the opera The Flying Dutchman. If you find opera confusing or intimidating or dry, you couldn't ask for a better way into the actual music and characters and story. That mismatch of tone, tragic opera and goofy cartoon, could have been a disaster, but What's Opera Doc and the similarly brilliant Rabbit of Seville create a perfect blend of high drama and campy slapstick. And I think it works so well because of a principle that Elmer Fudd never seems to learn. The more serious and imposing a force tries to be, the better it pairs with the absolutely ridiculous. Thanks again for listening, and let me know your thoughts at Matt Baume on Twitter or at Sewers of Paris, or with a review on iTunes. Visit sewersofparis.com to become a part of the Sewers family by supporting the show on Patreon. It's thanks to folks like you that the show can exist, and I'm so grateful to everyone who's taken a minute to pledge their support. And join us for another laid-back chit-chat live stream. The next one's coming up Saturday, June 22nd at 9 a.m. Pacific. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And check out Queens of Adventure, my other podcast featuring drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons comedy quest. We're doing a special preview weekend at the end of June, making over 20 hours of backer-exclusive bonus episodes available for anyone to listen to. Visit queensofadventure.com or follow at Dungeon Drag on Twitter for more information. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.